Thank you very much. Dziękuję. Good evening, everybody. I'm very honored to be here, and I first of all would like to thank Nili Amit that invited me to give this lecture, and everybody that is responsible for organizing this evening. As you see, in this talk is about women in the history of the State of Israel and also in the history of the Zionist project, which is part of this exhibition, this core exhibition of the museum, the part that this goes to the 19th century and around the 20th. This talk is covering really long timelines. So we are talking about right from the beginning of the Zionist settlement in Eretz Israel, in Palestine, in 1880, through the story of the Jewish community in Palestine, the Zionist community under the British mandate during the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, until the establishment of the State of Israel on the 14th of May in 1948. And we'll also take a look at the State of Israel at the first years, the first decades around the 1950. As you see from the pictures and also from the title, my motivation is to talk about the roles of women, the contribution, their part of Israeli history, Zionist history at the time. And the title, Myth and Reality, really illustrate or demo or shows us some kind of a gap between what we know about the history of Israel and what actually happened. So the gap between the myth and reality in history. And to discover the roots of this gap, we have to ask who tells us the story, who tells us the history of Israel, of the Zionist, who is responsible for the narrative, which is familiar. And I guess if you were here at the previous lectures, I guess other professors might talk about the narrative like Ben-Gurion or the other major subjects in Israeli history. So I would like to think about it and ask what exactly is the point of view and what can we learn when we are focusing on women. In the matter of this story, we are talking, of course, about the Zionist narrative. And I think the question of who wrote this narrative depends, of course, time and place, but eventually we can give it an answer. The people that wrote history was just the people that has the ability to write, and also the people that has the ability to pass over, to get through what they wrote, and also to publish it, you know, in textbooks, in museums, in other ways to spread the story. And when we open the books of the Zionist history or the Zionist idea, the Zionist movement, the Zionist community in the land of Israel, the State of Israel, of course, we can see that the main characters are mostly men. And because history were wrote mostly by men, and also in the matter of Zionism, they are represented as some kind of founding fathers of the Zionist idea, and I think you are familiar with them. Of course, Theodor Herzl is, I think it's the famous one while we are talking about founding fathers of Zionism. He was the founder of the modern political Zionism. He was a journalist. And he was the founder of and president of the Zionist organization. And he is considered also the one that is author of the vision of the Jewish state. And I think that if you're looking for Zionism, like if you're Googling Zionism and you're looking for images, I guess this is one of the famous image that you will see. Also, we can see Chaim Weizmann, who was a scientist and a leader of the Zionist movement, and also served as the first president of the state of Israel. Also David Ben-Gurion, of course, and the first prime minister of the state of Israel. He is considered as the architect of the state of Israel, as we said, mostly founding father, but founding fathers, but the founding father. And also Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, who was a Zionist labor movement leader, the second president of the state of Israel. And all of them were married, and all of them had family. And the question is, where is the wife? Where is the woman that was part of their lives? Sometimes the woman was totally absent from the Zionist history, like Jolie Nashauer, Theodor Herzl's wife, which was not considered as somebody that was supporting or taking part of the role on Herzl's Zionist activists, and I must say almost hidden from the story, even his family story, which is very, very interesting. Sometimes we are familiar with the wife, like Vera Weizmann, but Vera Weizmann was not only the wife of the first president of the United, of the state of Israel, because if I'm saying president, it's something that goes, you know, with other places. She was a Zionist activist, and she was a medical doctor, and she was one of the founders of VITSO. VITSO was Women's International Zionist Organization, but mostly Vera Weizmann is considered as the wife of Chaim Weizmann, as I said, mostly the first lady of the state of Israel. Sometimes they are well known as the wife of this man, like Paula Ben-Gurion, which was well known as David Ben-Gurion's wife, and she was represented most of the time as the one that was taking care of the family, him, their three children, but not actually more than that. And sometimes it's a woman also that was not only the first lady, if I'm speaking about Rachel Yanait Ben-Tzvi. And she was a teacher, she was an educator, she was a leader in labor Zionist part of Working Women Council, and definitely not only the second first lady of Israel. Rachel Yanait Ben-Tzvi is really a Hebrew name. When she was born, her name was Golda Lishansky, but she changed it because she wanted a Hebrew name, not Golda, but Rachel, and Yanait, as you see, if we're talking about the last name or the surname, it's something that goes when you're walking around in the core exhibition, if you're talking about names of the Jewish people. She decided it will be Yanait, and she kept it. Also Yanait and also Ben-Zvi, which is kind of fair if we're talking about three or four generations before us. She was activist in the Zionist movement, and she wrote many books and many articles. And in one of her books, she mentioned a conversation she had with Ben-Gurion. There was something like the same age. They were both of them were born in 1886. And she was writing about a conversation she had with him when they were young, something like 20-something or their early 30s. And the conversation was about women and about the way that women can be part of the society and contribute to the society. And as she said, about the status of women. And she said, on the topic of women, David, which means David Ben-Gurion, argued so that I was forced to reply, why are women so backward? And why do they not show their talents in sciences or even their favorite fields such as music or art? And she was sharing her feeling regarding this quote, and she said, "I felt guilt for all women in every generation on my shoulders. I tried to say that because of men, women were pushed to the narrow and limited sphere of housework. Since women in every generation are detached from the society's problems, there is no wonder that women are so far behind." So the assumption of Rachel Yanait Ben-Zvi was women are talented, such as the way Ben-Gurion was saying, talented in science, talented in music, arts, and any other field, but the environment keeps them at home. The environment is restricted them to show their talents, their abilities, no matter in any field. So the norms of the society is the one that is different and restrict women. Because by these norms, women are at home in the public sphere, in the private sphere, and men are outside in the public sphere. So the question is not only what you can do, but what you are able to do. And the destiny, if, as you know, of women is mostly motherhood. And it, of course, it includes Jewish women, especially Jewish women, if we are talking about the state of Israel at the early times. So this role as a woman to be a mother actually, and in practice, comes that are restricted and limited the roles in the society. But the argument of Ben-Gurion is positive and quite simple. Women are talented. Nobody, as Ben-Gurion argued in this conversation, is not. There's no limits for women. And if they would like, they can do so. And it's very common argument, and that's why I'm emphasizing it, because it's very common argument in the Zionist narrative, and especially the way that people see the history of Zionism and the state, mostly in the state of Israel, because the assumption is there is no discrimination, there is no restriction. And also during the history of Israel, because the assumption is that if a woman wants, she can. It means, yes, she can do it. She can be even prime minister. And as we know, we have a proof. Because in the state of Israel, a woman was a prime minister. It was Golda Meir. And it's sometimes the best example to this argument of Ben-Gurion. If a woman wants, a woman can. And Golda Meir was the prime minister. She was born in Kiev in 1898. Her name was Golda Mabovich. And when she was a kid, the family immigrated to the United States. And when she was a teenager, she became an activist Zionist. And she immigrated to Palestine, Israel, in 1921. And immediately, almost immediately, she started her public activities in the labor movement. First in the Working Women Council, but very soon in the general public sphere as the head of the political department in the Jewish Agency. And after that, she became a minister. She was the Minister of the Foreign Affairs and Minister of Labor. And for a long time, she was the only woman in the cabinet of Israel as a minister. She also was one of the two women to sign the Israeli Declaration of Independence in May 14, 1948. And I guess right now you are wondering who is the second one, and don't worry, I will talk about it in a few minutes. As I said, most of the time, at least in the state of Israel, She was not only the Minister of Labour and Foreign Affairs, but she was the only woman in the Israeli government. And in her autobiography, she said that Ben-Gurion, who was the Prime Minister, used to give her a compliment. He said, "You are the only man in my cabinet." And as you see, in a way, he gave her a compliment, because if somebody is saying to you, "You are really a man," it means that you are tough. It means that you are willing to do what it takes to do, and do it whatever it takes. And she also wrote it in her autobiography, and she was marked in her autobiography about it. And she said, "I was very much doubt that any man would have been flattered if I had said about him that he is the only woman in the government." Which actually means, if I'm saying to you that you are a man, of course, it's a compliment, but as she said, I don't think somebody's going to be flattered if I said he is a woman. So she was aware to the fact that that she had a compliment by Ben-Gurion, but I think it's also something that shows us that she was aware about the women's status in Israeli society. But I must say that it's women's status and all the question of women was not directly in her middle public politic activity. She was sometimes the only one, and as if you're familiar a bit in the feminist discourse, she was what is called the queen bee, which means she was in really high position, but she didn't promote other women to be in the public sphere such as she. And sometimes feminists in Israel were kind of proud of her, but on the other side, a bit angry, because she's saying, okay, if you are there and you are the prime minister or the in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, maybe you should promote more women to other positions. But it's something that, as we can see, was not that much. While she was a prime minister, the number of women in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, were very low. 8 women were out of 120 parliament members were women. But we have to be optimistic, and we have to, of course, look at the bright side, because when she was the prime minister from 1969 to 1974, she proved that women can do it, that women in Israel can be a prime minister. And I must say that when, I don't know what you thought about the lecture before you came here, but sometimes when you say women in Israel and myth and reality and men and women's status, right away people are thinking about Golda Meir. And in my own experience, when I was teaching at Tel Aviv University about Zionism and the State of Israel from students that came all over the world and also from Poland, and I asked them to choose a figure or choose a man or woman to focus, almost every student that chose to write something about a woman chose Golda Meir. Sorry. It's no wonder, because sometimes when we're thinking about women in Israeli history, we are seeing something like that, right? Because we see it in groups or in other names in the background. And as you see, of course, in every chapter of history of Israel, we can find women. But sometimes, if we're talking about defense force, we can see women in undergrounds, in the Haganah, the defense that was established in the 20s and in other undergrounds during the British Mandate. And in this picture, we see young women in the Palmach strike forces. It was a unit that young men and women were part of, it as just a typical tzabar, a typical sabra, the typical neo-Jew that is holding a weapon or a gun, and we actually don't know her name, and while we are looking or reading in the history texts, we're not actually asking who exactly she is, because she became some kind of a symbol for women. Sometimes we found women in the political aspect, in political movements and parties, like Working Women's Council. The picture is black and white, but the flags are definitely red. So we can see women in Hadassah or Vito that are very busy in social work or welfare or education or health, and not actually always regarding defense, but regarding social life. Sometimes we see them as mothers and as households, women that were mothers of babies, and women that were cooking and doing the laundry. And most of it, they are something like at the background of the history of Zionism or the history of Israel. They didn't actually write history because I guess they didn't have any time to do it. If we're talking about the question of who wrote history, so who wrote history? The one that has time for it and had to be able to do so. And as Virginia Woolf mentioned in her Womb of Its Own, you have to have the ability to do so. And these women were so busy doing other things. So it's not, doesn't of course mean that they are not part of history. So if you're taking a moment to take a look at this picture, we might think, what were their names, their dreams, what did they think, what was their own stories, and what was their contribution to the state of Israel. Because we already know that history is not only his story, but it's also her story. So if we're thinking about the term history, it's not only the history of men, like his story, and but also the story of women, the her story, not only the founding fathers, but also all the women. Because history belongs also not to the people that were standing on stage, but also to the people that were background, not only the majority, but also the minorities, regarding race, regarding religion, regarding sex, regarding also gender perspective, the way that we see men and women in social and cultural differences. That's a different aspect than what we are viewing when we are reading history. And it's not that easy. We have to look for it. We have to find it. We have to go not only to the government and not only to the majority and not only to the prime minister office, but also to the people. And it's much more difficult when you are writing history, because you have to have the documents. And also this gender perspective gives us, as the historian John Scott, the American historian John Scott, was marking, I make no claim to total vision, nor to having found the category that will finally explain all inequality in all operation, all history. My claim is more modest, that gender offers both a good way of thinking about history, which means that we have another aspect and we can maybe see history different. So basically we have two aspects of that. First, we have to look for the hell story, to look for the women and ask what are their stories. And that's the first phase, to get to know the stories, to get to know the new information about women, to find its her stories. And the assumption is it will enrich us, because we will have something more to know or to read or to be explored to about the history of Israel. And this year we are talking about 70 years to the state of Israel. So I would like to tell you seven stories about seven women in the history of Zionism in Israel, women that were in different fields and different spheres. Some of them, I guess, you will know, and the other maybe less. But I think every one of them, and especially all of them together, can light the history of Zionism and Israel. The first one will be a pioneer from the first Aliyah in the early 19th century. The second one is going to be a pioneer of a founder of a unique Zionist settlement, which means the kibbutz, and I know that you already heard about it, so maybe we can get to know the principle of equality in the kibbutz in a different way when we are talking about women. We will tell a story about one of the women from this group, Zionist suffragists that were part of the Union of Hebrew Women to for Equality, Equal Rights in Palestine. We will talk about a woman that represents heroism in the Holocaust. Maybe you're familiar with her regarding the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. We will tell a story about a woman that were that was a pioneer in aviation in the state of in Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, because she was the first one that was trained as a pilot. And we'll talk about the other woman, as I promised, the second one that was signing the declaration of the state of Israel, and she is the second one. Golda Meir was one of them. She was the second one, and finally, we will tell a story about a woman that were a really a major character in Israeli society during the 1950s, the first decade of the State of Israel. So let's start with the first one. And the first one is connected to the term first Aliyah, which means the first immigration of Jews to Palestine, to Eretz Israel, and as Zionist. And this is Olga Hankin. She was born in 1852 in Russia. And when she was a teenager, she left her parents' house and she decided she wanted to be a midwife and to learn this profession. It wasn't very possible for Jewish women to do so at the time, but eventually she did, and she worked as a midwife in Russia. And her family, the Belkind, were making Aliyah, and her father asked her, please come to the land of Israel to help your sister, Fania, because she's frightened and she needs you as her midwife while her time comes. And she left Russia, and her lover was staying there. And as family says, she decided to go to Eretz Israel because the land of Israel is more precious for her than the lover that she left there behind. And she was in arriving to Rishon LeZion, a Mosheva, that the name was the first to Zion. A few of her family already left, was living there. And it was a Mosheva which was supported by Rothschild. And after a year that she was making the Aliyah, there was a conflict between the farmers in the Mosheva and the clerks of Rothschild. And she was gathering with other women, and eventually they solve this conflict and get to a compromise together. It's something that it's not actually a part of the story of Rishon LeZion as something that happened on stage, because the conflict was about to end, but it was solved because of women, Olga Hankin and other women from that Mosheva, and also Adelaide Rothschild, the Rothschild's wife. At the time, her family was in Rishon LeZion, she met Yehoshua Hankin, and with Yehoshua Hankin, she was participated in the purchase of lands in Eretz Israel for Zionist movement. As I said, she was a midwife. So if we are talking about trying to buy lands in Eretz Israel in at the time, you have to get some information before that. And in the beginning, if we're talking about Olga and Yehoshua Hankin, at the end of the 1880s, no one yet believed in Yehoshua Hankin's skill as a real estate agent, I must say, but they trusted Olga Hankin. And as you can see, they fall in love and they got married. He was 22 at the time, she was 35. The families were really trying to set this love story apart because, you know, 12 years, 13 years between the husband and wife is something that didn't go very well at the time. But I must say that all the books say that love was stronger than everything. And because of her, Yehoshua Hankin was able to get loans to buy those purchases, to purchase these lands like in Israel Valley and other lands in Israel. She was going all around by herself, and this is one of her famous pictures. She was holding her whip and she was going on her horse by herself, and she said, "I'm going on my own." She was known as a strong woman, and she should be careful from strong women. You can see them, Yehoshua and Olga Hankin, in later years. They didn't have any children on their own, which when we're thinking about a midwife and her own story, it's quite interesting. And in history books, and also if you're looking her at websites, she's described as the wife who helped her husband, the helper, which sometimes in Hebrew it calls Ezer Keneged. She was part of and not the real thing, the one that was going with Yehoshua Hankin and not always on her own, but she was a woman on her own because she was surrounded with other women. This picture is also showed in the Core exhibition, if you are recognize it, because you see Olga Hankin and Manya Shochat, she was also Zionist activists, Shoshana Feinberg, her niece, and Doba Belkind, also a relative, and Alexandra Belkind, which was a physician. And I think that this picture, more than everything, shows something about women and also the power of women, because her niece and also her niece's daughter keep saying that she was a feminist, maybe not in the term feminist, but she was encouraging mostly the girls in the family to learn, to have a professional, to make a progress. And I must say, they did. The second woman I would like to talk about belongs to the other wave of Aliyah, of immigration of Jews as Zionists to Eretz Israel, and her name was Miriam Baratz. And when we are talking about women during the early Aliyah, the early immigrations to Eretz Israel, we usually talk about pioneers. It's something that goes all around the term pioneer. And Miriam Baratz was definitely a pioneer, because if we're saying pioneer, we think about somebody that did something on the first time. And she did. Most of the time, she was the first. First, she made an aliyah when she was 16 in 1905. And she was establishing, she was one of the founders of Degania, which was the first kibbutz. As you see, that's the earliest picture I found from Juni. That's the early times of Degania. And she established the koshed in Kibbutz Degania, which was well known in the local milk industry later on. she had to fight for it because it wasn't easy. When she said she wanted to take care of the only cow in Dgania, the other members of the kibbutz said something like, we've got somebody else to do it. But she said, I want to do it. But he said, no, you won't be able to take care of the cow. And as she said, the men in Dgania were responsible for the cow. And I demanded and asked to do it myself, but they mocked at me. They didn't give her the opportunity to do so, but she never gave up. She was looking for help and looking for a way to learn how to take care of the cow. And she found the wife of the Arab sheikh not far away from Umjuni, and she asked her for help. And she taught us, she taught her how to do it. And as she said, we had a secret convent as women. And she gave me a lesson in dairy work. And after a while, she went in the middle of the night and she did what she had to do. And after this was found out, she was telling later, it became the most discussed topic of the day. After a short fight, the members agreed that I should take responsibility of the cow since I have proved that I was an expert in this work. So definitely we can see that she was a pioneer, that even they said that the cow shed is off limits for her and for women, she chose to make a change by herself. So if the door is closed, she will find a way to get in and to enter. She also asked for another woman to help her, some kind of a network that we can see in other times. I don't know if you see the last sentence that she was saying, since I have proved that I was an expert, which means sometimes a woman can do something or other women can do something after one woman was proved that women can do it. So it's also a question that sometimes I think it's relevant, of course, also today. But the key here was to give a woman a chance. And if you're giving her a chance or the opportunity to take a man's role, she, if she proves it, she opens the door for other women to do it as well. And in her case, it's something that we can see later on, because she was not only breaking the gender borders, but she became a master and she experted in the Netherlands and also in the States. And her quotient became the territory of women in Dgania for years. Only women were taking care of the cows in Dgania. Also, she did for years when she was really old. Somebody asked her, are you not too old for the cows? So she said, whoa, that's this way we can make it more. Age is irrelevant. The main thing is willingness and not the age. And she was, I think, more than 60 years old when she said it. She kept doing it, and as I mentioned before, she was a pioneer in many aspects, and another aspect is being a mother in the kibbutz. She was the first kibbutz member that had a child, and first take a look at this beautiful picture, I think, of Miriam and Yosef Baratz with Gideon, the first child in Dgania. Because she was the first kibbutz member that became a mother. And it's something that you have to deal with it in a way, because she's working and now she has to take care of the baby, or maybe all the kibbutz should do it, and how exactly should it work. And as she told, the common opinion was that I need to dedicate all day to take care of the baby. And definitely she said, I objected. And she said, I knew that by that I would be separate from the public, from the kvutza, from the kibbutz, from the whole group, and I did it my way. And if we're asking, okay, how could she do it? Think about the term superwoman, because I think she never get a chance to sleep, because she said, I continued my life as it was and overcame all the difficulties. I woke up at 3 a.m. in the morning, just imagine it, 3 a.m. in the morning, to work and didn't stop until 10 o'clock at night, 10 p.m. And I was happy, and that happiness gave me the energy to work without sleeping. And I must say, I just a bit of a doubt about it, because for a long time it's not very easy, you know, wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and get sleep at 10 o'clock at night. It leaves you something like, I don't know, 5 hours. Even by that, it's not very easy. And maybe it's a nostalgic point of view, but it can tell us something about the way that women are trying to think of solutions, of how to do what. And I think it's something that not only Miriam Baratz is dealing with at the time. The third woman that I would like to tell you about is a story that belongs to the 20s of the 20th century. It's the story of the Zionist suffrage in fight in Eretz Israel. And this woman is Sarah Azriyahu. She is one of the leaders of the struggle to right to vote in the Jewish community in Eretz Israel, in the land of Israel, during the British Mandate, which was really a long struggle. It took 9 years until women from the establishment of the Jewish Zionist community in Palestine during the Mandate, until they got the right to vote. She was born in 1873, and as she said in her family, she didn't felt any discrimination between boys and girls. But when she became a woman, she said, I was aware of two major problems. First problem, the status of Jewish people. And the other problem, status of women. And she thought that the key to progress of women and to solve the problem of status of women was to be independent. That if a woman has the proof that she is a person of her own, she doesn't doesn't have to be depend in a father or husband or son. She can make a living by herself. She herself was a teacher and educator, and she and her husband, Yosef Azriyahu, was one of the 66 families that founded Tel Aviv. She was one of the leaders of the women suffrage movement in Eretz Israel. It was something that it's not only interesting that we're talking about the right to vote, which wasn't something that had to be going with, there was a fight around it, but it was also a union of women organizations that was gathering together for this purpose, because when the Jewish community, the Zionist community in the land of Israel, was starting to build the National Institute, the struggle from 1917 to 1926 was to allow women to vote. And this union was covering leaders from different associations of women in Haifa and Tel Aviv and Jerusalem that were getting together as a union. Sarah Azriyahu was one of them, as you can see her in the first row, second to the right. And in one of her speeches, which was many regarding this fight, she said, we are the daughters of the nation who wish to fulfill the national obligation that fate and thrust upon us. we are ready to do what all it takes. In this homeland, we'll prevail liberty and equality for all its citizens, men and women, and as loyal partners in the obligations that we were willing to fulfill, we demand our equal parts in rights also, which means we demand the active and the passive right to vote, not only the obligations, but also the right. And it's something that is very basic when we are talking about women. And she saw it not only as a goal, but also in a way, because that's way women we can be able to be part of the public life. If we're thinking about Golda Meir and others, this is the first step of this way. And she also was talking about that not to ask for or demand for rights from the government, but to be part of the government. So not to be something that is asking for rights, but to be part of the government that are making the decisions. After the establishment of the State of Israel, she published a book about this struggle, and she made a long list of the problems that we still have to solve, like the discriminations, if we're talking about the law, about legislation in Israel, about the fact that equal legal rights for men and women are something that have to be based in the law in the State of Israel, and I must say that this problem is still need to be solved. She also, by the way, asked to women to increase the number in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, and in the government. And if we are back thinking about Golda Meir, the only minister, and then the prime minister, we can see that also in the Israeli parliament we still have a way. Right now, 25% of the Israeli parliament are women, which means there is a progress, but still there is a way. The fourth woman I would like to speak about, I think you are familiar with her. She also is mentioned in the core exhibition of this museum. And she's connected to this place, to Warsaw. And I think that she will, I guess, will be part of the mentioning of Ghetto Warsaw uprising this year, which would be the 75 year of this uprising, because she was one of the symbols of heroism of Jews during the Holocaust, especially in Israel. I'm talking about Tzivia Lubetkin. She was born in 1914 in Biten, in Poland. And when she was 16, she was a part of a Zionist socialist youth movement. And I see there are a few with blue shirts over there, right? So I'm sure you're familiar with Tzivia Lubetkin and this the social Zionist youth movement Freiheit that she was part of. It was merged with Dror, the movement Dror. Dror means liberty or freedom. And she was one of the major activists in this movement. In the summer of 1939, she was a delegate to the Zionist Congress in Geneva in Switzerland. And after that, she came back to Warsaw. And a few months after the outbreak of World War II, she came back to Warsaw to be with her friends, to be with her members of the movement. And in July 1942, when the Jewish fighting organization was gathering together, she was the woman that was the most leading in this organization. She participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in 1943 and in the Warsaw Uprising also in 1944. And she was in the State of Israel among the founders of Kibbutz Lochamei HaGetaot, the kibbutz that was called after the ghetto fighters, and it called the Ghetto Fighters Kibbutz. Her husband was Yitzhak Zuckerman, Antek, which was also a major commander in the Jewish fighting organization in the Eyal. And they lived in Kibbutz Lochamei HaGetaot until she passed away in 1978. In Israel, Zivia Lubetkin became a metaphorical character, a hero, because she played a central role in shaping the attitude of the Israeli society, and before that, the pre-state, regarding the Holocaust and also Holocaust survivors. And she's really a big part of shaping this concept of Holocaust and heroism, which is very well known in Israel regarding the Holocaust. And her name was also very familiar at the Land of Israel during the war, during the early 40s. In the early summer in 1943, there was a false information in Eretz Israel that Zivia Lubetkin was killed during the uprising, and she became a symbol, and one of the things that was written about her was Zivia. This name has become synonym with the pioneering underground, the pioneering movement in occupied Poland, Polish Jewry, imprisoned within the walls of Warsaw. After a while, it apparently was known that it was a mistake, and Zivia Lubetkin is alive. She was still a model, she was still a symbol, and became a hero. And when she met the young Israelis, Yitzhak Sadeh, commander in the Palmach, wrote about it. When they met Zivia Lubetkin, they felt as if she was one of us, already belonging to the Land of Israel, that the working, fighting, and struggling Eretz Israel now had another comrade, soldier, a military leader. So she was, as you see, a comrade, she was a soldier, she was a military leader, she was very powerful, if we're talking about the way that she was represented as an active, as a leader, as a Sabra. And after a while, she came to the Land of Israel in 1946, she was invited to tell about the Jews in Warsaw and in Poland, and she addressed a large audience regarding the destruction and the revolt of the Jews in Poland, and especially in Warsaw, and mostly in Warsaw ghetto uprising. One of the addresses was in Kibbutz Yagur in 1946, and the other testimony was in the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem in 1961, and the impression was huge. In the newspaper, there it was written something like, all ears were open, all eyes were focused on the Jewish hero of our generation. It was a story about destruction and revolt, and one of the special moments of this story was when she was telling the audience about the beginning of the uprising in Warsaw. And she said, when the Germans came near the foot of one of our strong points and passed by information, and we threw the bombs and the hand grenades, and we saw the German blood pouring in the streets of Warsaw after so much Jewish blood and tears had previously flowed in the streets of Warsaw, we felt within us great rejoicing, and it was no important what would happen the following day. She spoke, this is a quote from the Eichmann trial testimony, and she gave speeches in Israel and also here in Poland. I guess you are familiar where exactly this speech was taking, right? In Warsaw, this picture is from 1958, and her character was really powerful because she was representing armed resistance. And it's not only something that was considered important, it's not a traditional role of women. And when you are a woman and you are part of this uprising, it makes it even powerful at the time. So it makes us think about women that are crossing the borders. What exactly are happening to them when they are crossing the borders and they're doing something that is traditionally is related to men. They are holding guns, they are part of armed resistance, and it's something that is a question of how we are see them as a society. This one really is connected to the next woman, which also did something that it's not very familiar for a woman, and this is Rachel Markowski-Landau. And as you can see here in this picture, she is, was a young woman who decided after she became a teacher that she would like to be a pilot, but first thing first. Rachel Markowski-Landau was born in 1910, and it's not a mistake, she was her life was long. She passed away when she was 101 a few years ago. She was born in Lodz. I must say Lodz, right? They correct me, say Lodz. Everybody is saying Lodz, but I know that I have to say Lodz. And she made an aliyah with her family in 1925. She was 14 and they lived in Tel Aviv. She studied biology and then education, and she became a teacher at Tel Aviv. And she was the first woman from a Jewish community in Eretz Israel to be trained as a pilot. She was a pilot in the flying course of what is was called Aviron, the first Jewish aviation firm. That was belonged to the Jewish Agency and the National Council and also the Histadrut Labor Union Organization. And she was one of three women that started the flight course, and she was the only woman who finished it eventually. And she was trained and practicing, and at the time she was still a teacher in Tel Aviv, and eventually in 1940, she finished the course and she became a pilot in 1940. It was during the British Mandate. And when she was looking back at the time she was part of this training and this flying course, she said, "It was a conflict with me between it was dangerous, it is difficult, it's not for girls, and I want to do it." And sometimes it's a conflict, I think, that women feel in other occasions, that it might be dangerous, it might be difficult, it's not for girls, it's not traditionally for girls, but I want to do it, so I will do it. And she said, "I didn't do it for the sake of women equality, I wanted to defend the country. I knew I was not worth less than any of the boys." And she was the only one at the beginning, as I said, so I think it's her thoughts illustrates the difficulty of women in all male fighting unit, because she was the only one. She didn't have any sister in arms to be part of. And as you can see from this quote, she didn't see the fact that she was a pilot as an achievement of all women, but something that is quite private, quite her own achievement. What is actually interesting that being a woman as a pilot was something that was she was able to do things that men couldn't, because the British officers weren't suspecting her that she is transferring something from this place to the other while she flew from different places in Eretz Israel, in Palestine. She was landing here and there, and they thought maybe she's just a spoiled young woman that has an airplane and she goes all around. And she was transferring equipments and weapons, and she sometimes she in a way took the stereotype of a woman to be an advantage. After the establishment of the State of Israel, she wasn't a pilot in the Israeli Air Force, but she remained in the air business, and she chaired the Israeli Flight Club. And as you see, she was a teacher, and here you can see her with boys and girls in this area. Earlier, while we talked about Golda Meir, I was mentioning there was two women who signed the establishment of the State of Israel. So this is the other one, Rachel Cohen Kagan. And as you see in the picture, Rachel Cohen Kagan signing the Declaration of Independence in May 14, 1948. She was when she was younger, she learned mathematics and chemistry in Odessa in Russia, and she made an aliyah in 1919. And here she was an activist in social care and welfare. She was the chairwoman of VITSO in Israel. She was a member of the Knesset in Women's Party. It was the first, and I must say, if you ask me, the only time there was women party in the Israeli parliament. She was part of the national community of VITSO. She was the representative of VITSO in the national community, and that's why she became one of the 37 men and women who signed the declaration of the State of Israel, and as I said, one of the only two women, I added the only, to sign the Israeli Declaration of Independence. 37 people signed this declaration, 35 men and two women. And in 1949, in the first Knesset, the first Israeli parliament, she was the head of the Women's Party, which was a party of, as you see, of VITSO and Union of Hebrew Women for Equal Rights, the one that was belonged also to Sarah Azariahu, which was two organizations that gathered together and as a party. And she was talking about it while she was a member of the Knesset, which is interesting because in her work as a Knesset member, as the parliament member, a journalist asked her how it is to be a woman in the Israeli parliament in 1949. And she said, despite the rhetoric regarding progress, men see women in parliament as a special thing. It is simple. It is hard for them to forget that I am a woman. She also said that men need to grow up and eventually understand that women can be part of the parliament, and she thought that women should be in parliament. Women should be part of the government of every state, but mostly the State of Israel, because not only because women can do it and all the things that we said before, but she said, I have no doubt that through the active participation of women in national affairs, there would be more care and concern for the weak and those who left behind in our state. She said that the attitude to their problems would be more human, and without doubt the situation would be improved. And if we're talking about her background in VITSO and in welfare and social work during the years, we can see that she's focusing not in defense, not in question of security and not question of war, but the question of society and be human regarding the citizens. I think this is something that is quite unique, and maybe it's one of the explanations of the fact that it was one on the only occasion in the Israeli parliament where we had a women party. In 1951, she was back to be a leader in VITSO. And after 10 years, she ran again to the Knesset, but not in a women party, but in other party. The seventh woman, I want to tell you her story, was a woman that in the early years of the State of Israel became a role model. And this is Rivka Gruber. Her story is a story of a dedication and loyalty to people, if we are talking about her own family and many other young Israelis at the time. She was born in 1902, and when she was in 1925, she made an aliyah. She was an educator, she was a teacher, and also she served in the ATS of the British Army. And with her husband, Mordechai Gruber, they had three children, two boys and one girl. And she imparted the sons and also her daughter to her own values, to volunteer, to be loyal, to dedicate their life to the State of Israel to be or to come. And when their boys, Ephraim and Tzvi, were children, they would like to play as soldiers and we like imagine games or plays. They were fighters and comrades. And during the Second World War, she was volunteering to the ATS for 2 years. The ATS was a women's branch of the army and it was formed in 1938. Many women were volunteered to the ATS and also from the Yeshuv, from Palestine, Zionist women. She served 2 years in the ATS, and the children stayed in Eretz Israel with their father. And when Ephraim, the oldest one, was 15, he wrote her and asked her to come back home. He said something like, "It's my turn. I don't want my mother to protect me anymore right now. It's my turn." Or my time to do it. Both her sons were killed in the Israeli War of Independence in 1948. Ephraim, the first one, and 4 months after that, Tzvi. As you see in the pictures, Ephraim Gruber killed on March 26, 1948, and Tzvi Gruber was killed in July 8 in 1948. After Ephraim was killed, she wrote to her friend in a personal private letter. She said, "We were fortunate to be part of the upbringing of one of the youngest Jews, such as had not been born for many generations. Only with our return to the land of Israel and our putting down such roots, we could raise such young women." And after Tzvi Gruber was killed, she wrote to her, "We were destroyed, but we are not defeated." And I think this quote says it all, because she was an activist, not only in commemoration of her sons, but also in the aid of new immigrants at the time to the State of Israel. She wrote many books. One of them was called "With My Sons." And soon after her two sons were killed, David Ben-Gurion, the prime minister, called her mother of sons, Em Habanim, and it was kind of a title that Rivka Gruber got through the years, mother of the sons. And with Mordechai Gruber, she did mostly everything volunteering. She was a teacher, she had her own school, she was educator. In 1976, she was awarded the Israeli Prize, a prize for special contribution to society and the state of Israel. And in 1979, when the Prime Minister Menachem Begin went to Washington to sign the peace treaty with Egypt, she was part of the Israeli delegation to appreciate her work at the time. In her last years, she was living in Tel Aviv, and 3 years after Mordechai Guber passed away, she put an end to her life. And after she passed away, which was a shock for the family and was a shock for many public figures at the time, a journalist named Ruth Bondi was writing about her. And if we see something that a woman wrote regarding this decision of this woman to put an end to her life, she wrote that the livingness of Rivka Guber was obvious, like she made from material that never ends. But maybe she also knew doubts, asked herself if the price she paid for the state was not too high. Everybody can live knowing he's required, loved, that he's necessary, that he has a mission that allows him to carry on his life. During the dark hours of illusion fails, and I see an abyss, and in it I'm looking for Rivka. So it's something that makes us think about, as Ruth Bondi wrote, about what we know about the fact that maybe she knew that the price was too high at that time. It's 7 women, and it's not enough. It's always not enough, but we can ask, what exactly can we learn from their stories, maybe all together as women, that let us think about something that regards the history of Zionism. So Olga Hankin, we can find streets named Olga Hankin. We can find her in history texts or books about the first Aliyah, mostly as a wife or a helper. And I think that she can teach us something about the first settlement in the Zionist project, not only on stage, but also backstage. Miriam Baratz and her fight to be part of the kibbutz and to do what men was usually doing is saying something about the equality, the main principle of the kibbutz movement, which was something very major element in the Israeli culture, but women has... That's for the drama. It's really important. I have to make some noise as a woman, right? So, otherwise you won't hear me. And I got 2, see? Women are raising their voice. Okay. And as I said, if everybody's talking about being equal in the kibbutz, Miriam Baratz proved us right from the beginning that it's not equal, that we have to struggle for it, and also we have to struggle for the right to vote, which is also something that we're not thinking about. Sometimes people, and also my students in Israel, are asking women really actually had to get the right to vote in the Jewish or the Zionist community in Palestine, and I'm saying yes, and they are asking back why don't I do it, know it enough about it. So something about the gap between the principle of equality between men and women in the Israeli history is not always in practice. Zivia Lubetkin is also a public figure in Israel, and I think it's very interesting to see what will be her part while we are talking about 75 years to the uprising, but she can tell us something about the major part of women in Israeli society commemoration of the Holocaust, and mostly when we are talking about women in the Holocaust at the time. Rachel Markovsky-Landau is not a major role in Israel regarding the history of the Israel Air Force. Most of the discourse regarding women as pilots are new regarding the 19s and even the last years, but Rachel Markovsky-Landau as the first one is teaching us that there were women that were pilots even before the state was established, and even in organizations that are dominant by men, like the Israeli Air Force, there is a her story that we should watch and take into account. Rachel Cohen Kagan tells us the story of the Israeli parliament as women's party, and as I said, at the time women were really a minority, something like 10% out of the parliament, and today 25% of the Israeli parliament are women, which is not quite enough. But she tells us that Golda Meir was not the only one in every aspect, because another woman was signing the Israeli declaration, and sometimes I think that her quotes can teach us how long is the way and how important the not only women's acts, but women's point of view is important for society. And finally, Rivka Guber, that is a role model as a mother in Israel, teaches something that even after you are becoming a role model, what exactly is part of their own life? What are they thinking? And I think that the fact she put an end to her life makes her think about her whole story different. And altogether, they teach us there are so many women we don't know, that we have so much to study, but we just have to start and look for it, because, as we said before, history is not only his story, but it's her story, which means, and I'm so happy to see so many women in the audience, because it's our stories. And we have to look for these our stories. And of course, the question is where? And where can we look for her story or our stories as women? First, in textbooks, of course, in internet websites, at the core exhibition of the museum. I think it will be quite interesting to go all around the exhibition and look for the women, or as somebody told me, look for the ladies in the core of exhibition, in the core exhibition. And we also just need to look around and also look around in our own stories to hear what exactly is going on, maybe in our own family, like to go and ask a relative about her story, maybe grandmother, maybe if you have a great-grandmother or an aunt, and I will give you and maybe an inspiration to do so, because it's not just to talk about it, but also to do it if we are talking about our story. This is a picture from Zichlin. It's a really small town. Somebody told me that nobody in Poland knows where exactly it is, so I think it's between Warsaw to Lodz, right? In the middle of... Somebody heard about Zichlin? Please tell me that somebody is. No? Okay. So it's quite a small place. And this is four girls at the picture. Hanna, Hinda, Zissel, and Sprinza Klinkovstein. The older one that is standing, she's my grandmother. And Zichlin is a town that is not very far away from Warsaw, but during the 30s, the early 30s in Zichlin, 30% of the population were Jews. And they lived in Zichlin from the 18th century, and after World War I, we can see parties and movements all around, Zionists and non-Zionists, and people that immigrate to Palestine in the second Aliyah and the third Aliyah, but mostly of most of them stayed in Poland in the 20s and in the early 30s, but through 1930 the time had changed, and the relationship between the Jews and the non-Jews in Sichlin were changed. And this family in 1936, the Klinkhofstein family, made an aliyah, these four girls and their parents, Hadassah and Daniel, and they lived in Tel Aviv. Hinda was 15, and when she was a bit older, she met a guy, and his name was Shlomo, and he came from Lodz. He was born and raised in Lodz, and in 1938, or I'm not sure, at the early of 1939, he made an aliyah. He was 19, and in Lodz stayed his parents and his three brothers. After the war, he was informed that only one of his four brothers was survived the Holocaust, not his parents, and two other brothers stayed in Lodz. He never talked about it, but Hinda knew, and he became later an officer in the Israeli Air Force. She was a household. She raised two daughters and had four grandchildren. One of them is me. And this is a picture from 1977. They spoke at home only Polish, Yiddish, and later Hebrew. I heard mostly the Yiddish, and I was the Maidele. As you know, the girl is Maidele in Yiddish. So visiting the poor exhibition at the museum, it's very personal to me, and I'm always looking for Sichlin. Lodz is easier for me to find, but and I found it. So eventually, if we are asking what exactly we can learn from this story, if we want to sum up, we can find women in every chapter of history. Just we have to look for it. It's not easy, but it's possible, and it's so great to do it, because we are eventually seeing the society in other points of view, and are really encouraging you to do so. And I would like to thank you for listening, and to say dziękuję bardzo za uwagę. I'm sure it will be fine. And toda raba.
Jeśli mają Państwo pytania, to zapraszamy. Teraz jest chwila na zadanie pytania. Pani doktor.
Mam trzy krótkie pytanka.
You will need to help me that.
Jak bardzo zaangażował...
Ah, okay. Or maybe you can translate it? No.
I can translate it, it's faster actually.
Mm. Okay. Mm. Have to find and to translate for everyone.
No, no, she can have it for you in this way, so it's
okay.
Fine. But just tell me if you... Proszę?
Jak bardzo były zaangażowane religijnie te kobiety? To jest pierwsze pytanie. Jaka była reakcja przywódców religijnych w Izraelu? I trzecie, jaka była reakcja w diasporze poza Izraelem? Dziękuję.
Thank you. And the question was regarding religion aspect. If those women were religious, or what was the attitude of the rabbis through these women? They came from sometimes from traditional families, but we're not definitely speaking about religious women, but women that were liberal and was willing to take part of the society. The rabbis didn't actually like the fact that women are taking part of this public sphere. This fight of the right to vote was long because of the rabbis, because the idea is that women should be at the private sphere, and Agudat Israel and other parties were definitely against this idea. And I must say it's still a problem in Israel when we are facing the question of women's status that is deeply rooted in the Torah, which is quite a problem for feminists that has to break one ceiling after the other. It's one of the things that Sarah Ezriyahu was marking as problem need to be solved, that the law should be equal for men and women, which I must say it's not yet to be done. So it's really relevant question to Israel, even for talking about nowadays.
So thank you for a very interesting lecture. And I was wondering, is it actually, I don't know if you can really answer this question, because maybe you cannot have such a comparison if you are living in Israel mostly, but is it really such a big difference between Israel being a religious society and, as you said, that it's rooted in the Torah, the position of the woman, between Israel and other countries that are, where the position of a woman is also lower, and it depends just, you know, on a different religion or in general on the patriarchal culture that basically shapes the position of the woman everywhere. So maybe I'm wondering if there is actually a difference
between women in Israel and women in other countries. First, I have to say that if we're talking about religious women or ultra-Orthodox women, we're talking about the minority in the Israeli society. Most of the Israeli society are not ultra-Orthodox or deeply religious. I think that it's not much different in other countries that where women had to fight norms and stereotypes that sometimes are connected to religion, but not always connected to religion, but still they have to fight for it, for the fact that they are, as Miriam Baratz, if you are a mother, you can be part of the public, can be part of, she said kvutza, but she meant the group and she meant the public sphere. So I think it's something that is common for other women around in other countries. And it's something that makes us think in universal aspect about the problems of women as mothers, as households, as being part of the parliament. Yeah.
Hello, I'd like to ask more about the role of women in the army today, because as I can see as a, let's say, outsider, mostly like this nowadays social media like Instagram, for example, there is Instagram account of IDF and something like Girls Defense. And what I wanted to say is, as I can see on IDF, mostly you can, let's say, see the men as the soldiers, as the people who will actually defend the country. And women, on especially this Girls Defense, they are actually shown as a model who look very well in the soldier uniform, but actually they are just, you know, women who looks nice. But on the other side, as I saw, it was very popular, the news that the training of the first tank women was finished and it was shown as a very successful, but still, is it like, what is the role actually of women in the army? Is it like they are treated the same as real soldiers, or is it more like, you know, they are just as not attraction, but something what looks nice? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. It's an important question, and I think that the public discourse in Israel, you can see that it's really an issue. So it's no wonder that you're seeing it in social media. I'm not sure if it's an attraction, but the question is what their part in the IDF. And in the beginning, it was very obvious that men, as you said, are soldiers, they are there to fight, and women are there to help. And if we are taking the example of Rivka Guber at the ATS, that was the model of the Israeli Defense Force in the beginning of time. If we are talking about women's force, they are there to help and to serve and to be part of, but not to be the one that holds the guns and go to have the fire. And I agree, totally agree, that it sometimes became an attraction. It's like these pictures, and this picture down there on the left is from the early 60s, but you can see from time to time those pictures, because it's an attraction, because in Israel, women had to go to the army, and it's quite different than other places. But there is it is an issue, because right now in Israel, there are many religious soldiers at the army that are not willing to cooperate with women next to them. And the question if a woman can be a pilot, and of course she does, from 1994, women are part of as pilot in the Israeli Air Force, but they're still a minority, and they still have to fight one after the other. And there's a huge debate about it, if women can take part, and from time to time there is someone that's saying some nonsense things about women and their abilities. And in the aspect of research, I can say that the IDF atmosphere is something that we can think about the Israeli society, because does a change in the IDF will influence the Israeli society, or vice versa? And researchers, mostly women that are researching the IDF history, saying that the changes need to be part of the Israeli society, and then it should reflect the IDF and not vice versa. So I think it's something that indicates the problems between men and women, and even don't have to be really religious if I'm connecting to other question for that, because as you see, even non-religious people can be very can hold very traditional opinions regarding women, that you can be a pilot, but don't forget to be a mother, and don't forget your part, and okay, it will go over, and then you will go to your traditional sphere eventually. So you're definitely not wrong, and the social media is right eventually. So that.
I have a similar question regarding women in politics. Are women involved in politics? Because from newspaper, we see only men.
You talk about nowadays?
Nowadays, current situation.
I think women are part of politics. I think that you are regarding the parliament and the government and the cabinet. Not enough, that's for sure. So if we're looking at the cabinet, there are not much ministers, even though there is more than one. Not enough, I think. And also, if I would allow myself to add something to your question, does they do things to promote women as parliament members or as ministers? Sometimes if you are taking a good look, you can see that they are really rarely taking gathering together for something, but most of them, they are part of their own parties, which leads us to the question how women can change things when they are part of politics. So the answer is yes, but also I think Israel has a way to go on, as Sarah Azriyahu mentioned in 1949, after 70 years you still have work to do.
Hi. So all the women that you mentioned were Ashkenazi, right? So I would like to ask about women who made Aliyah from other parts of the world, or women who live in Israel but are not Jewish, and their presence in the politics, the public sphere, social activism.
Thank you. It's an important question. And first time I say you're right. If we are talking about history of Israel, of course, we're not talking only about Ashkenazim. But if we are focusing on the early years, about the first Aliyah and the second Aliyah, and during the 20s until the 1948, we see mostly women that came from Europe. After that, if we're talking about the mass immigration, of course, women from other places, and I think it's quite, of course, it's not demonstrates everyone. I was focusing in women from regarding Zionism, because I think the fact that the state of Israel is defines herself as a Jewish state, and that's also a question that is very relevant: if it's a Jewish state and democratic state, and if it could go together. If we're talking about the Zionist history, we rarely find women that are not Jewish, and I must say even not Zionist, even though they are Jewish. So it's also a good question if we're looking on the textbooks and their representations. So I agree, this seven is not representing the whole story, and I think we will never be able to do it, to demonstrate the whole story. And I think that's the key, because always we know that there is another one, and another one that belongs to a minority group, and another one that is maybe minority twice. First is a Mizrahit, and then woman, and we have a lot of work to do in this hair story field. Thanks.
Nie ma więcej pytań, jak widzę, także bardzo Państwu dziękujemy. Thank you very much for your lecture. I zapraszamy na kolejne wykłady do Muzeum Polin.
Thank you very much.